Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder.
Stick them up.
Listen to Out There on Wednesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio for interviews and snippets of life from the paths and streets of Northampton. You can hear past editions of Out There archived at weatherbeard.com/out there. And it is indeed Wednesday, May 17th, 2017. And I have a very special live guest in the studio today, Bradford Little, who's come all the way from Chicago. Thanks for coming, Brad.
Thank you for having me here, Ruthie.
Brad is a director of the Hyde Park Nonviolent Resistance and Pacifist Center in Chicago, author of The Flaw in Deterrence, a book that he's distributing to colleges and universities in the area on his trip east, and... well, a longtime peace activist and an old friend of mine from my Chicago Catholic Worker days. So we'll have a lot to say later on in the show today. Some other things that I'm also going to play at the beginning of the show. Today, May 17th, is Bike to Work, Bike Commute Day, annual Bike Commute Day. And the Northampton Bike Breakfast was this morning downtown on the courthouse lawn. Free breakfast for cyclists. So I'm going to play the mayor, David Narkowitz, reading the proclamation of Bike Commute Day. Also, tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, May 18th, is the Florence Bike Breakfast from 7 to 9 at the Lilly Library. So come with your bikes. Lots of kids will stop by there on their way to school. I think last year there was a brigade of children and families on their way to Leeds Elementary School. So that's 7 to 9. There was something else in my mind about that. Oh, yeah, so this is the second annual Florence Bike Breakfast at the Lilly Library. You know what? I'm going to play this little clip from last Friday morning when I was doing downtown trash, downtown Northampton.
Right, so it's the first few weeks of May. You got all these people downtown, especially for Smith graduation. And what happens? Do you want your name or not?
My name is Ed Modulowski, and I've been here in Northampton homeless for years. I'm waiting on a VA disability. And so I'm on the streets just waiting around and touching base with a lot of people. And every freaking May, I see the police come out and they sweep the streets to try to clean it up. I mean, because there's a lot of homeless people and harassing. And we got big money coming in over the end of May because Smith College has graduation and they want a nice early town. You know, very understandable. But I think it'd be a lot cheaper instead of sweeping up the streets and throwing people in jail at a huge taxpayer expense. It was just Smith College just sponsors a party for all the homeless and marginal people on the streets over at Look Park. Throw some steaks on a grill, have a camp out or something like that to clean up the streets and keep people occupied over on the other side of town instead of filling up the jails. It'd be a lot cheaper and it'd create a lot of goodwill in town. You know, I could use a steak. Ribeye would be nice. Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you.
That's great.
All right. Thanks, Ed, for that great suggestion. So now I'm going to play the proclamation from the mayor. And also, this is like a four-minute clip. It's not all reading of the whereas of the proclamation, but also Mayor Narkowitz gives an update about like 10 bike-related projects in the city of Northampton.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Bike Week and happy Bike Commuter Day in the city of Northampton. Always great to be here at this annual breakfast. I do have a proclamation that I want to issue. It's entitled Bike Commute Day, May 17th, 2017, and it's in honor of Bay State Bike Week, May 13th through the 21st of 2017. Whereas bicycling contributes to the health and fitness of residents, provides mobility to young people, does not add noise or air pollution, and provides an inexpensive and convenient way to commute. And whereas cyclists have the same rights and duties as drivers of other vehicles, including the right to use our city streets, and whereas cyclists must follow traffic laws and as other vehicles, both for their own safety and for the safety of others. And whereas the city of Northampton offers bike paths, parks, rivers, and other scenic opportunity for cycling, recreation, and tourism. And the city has installed bike racks throughout our downtown and installed bike lanes to encourage cycling. And whereas bicycles are used in a variety of occupations, including by members of our Northampton Police Department and by the people who haul trash and recycling from our downtown, pedal people. And so now, therefore, I, David Jane Arkowitz, do hereby proclaim May 17th, 2017, to be Bike Commute Day in the city of Northampton and encourage all citizens who are able to cycle to work or school to take cognizance of cyclists and their travels. I urge citizens to consider bicycling as an efficient, planet-friendly, and enjoyable mode of transportation and recreation. In witness whereof, I have set my hand and imprinted the city seal this 7th day of May, 2017. Happy Bike Commute Day. I also wanted to just do one other little quick thing. I wanted to acknowledge Wayne Fiden, our incredible director of planning and sustainability. And I wanted to just give you kind of a quick like top 10, the 10 things we're working on in the city this year, or were long-term projects related to cycling. So I just want to sort of put together a list. Well, so number 10. Actually, we just got the approval by the TPC and the Planning Board of our major bike and pedestrian plan for the city of Northampton. It's a major look that we did, and we're going to be working on implementing some of those recommendations. Number 9, Pleasant Street. We've got major improvements underway using our state MassWorks grant and Complete Streets grant, which is going to include the city's first cycle track between Holyoke and Hockenham Road. It'll be grade separated on the inbound side, and it'll be buffered by car parking on the outbound side. Number 8, we're about to or hoping to purchase land off Burt's Pit Road this summer. That's a key to an eventual rail trail connection from Route 10 to Ryan Road School.
Yeah,
number
really
7, in my recently adopted capital improvement program, we've set aside additional funding for future rail trail design. Number 6, the access ramps at North Street and Edwards Square and the northerly side of Look Park have been designed and are awaiting funding. Number 5, the rail trail tunnel connecting Northampton Trails with the state trails under Railroad is well under construction and hopefully will be finished this year. Number 4, Damon Road, which is under a 25% design by MassDOT. We've got a bicycle and pedestrian path from Bridge Street to River Run. And we were hoping for public construction in 2019 and 2020. Number 3, the Rocky Hill Greenway Trail is at now 25% design, another extension of our amazing trail system. Number 2, on Tuesday, thanks to the generosity of the Northampton Cycling Club, we installed a new bike repair station that was donated by the Cycling Club in Pulaski Park. So we now have a great repair station as well as an air pump that people can be used. And number 1, the number 1 thing that we've been working on, last Friday I signed a $1.3 million contract, we're the lead community on it, for a 5-community Valley Bike Share program, which is going to set up a regional bike share program in Northampton, Amherst, South Hadley, Holyoke, and Springfield. We're the lead agency, and I want to credit Wayne Fiden, who's been a leader on all of these things, and we appreciate the work that he does. So thanks again, and happy Bike Week.
So that was Mayor David Narkowitz speaking at the Northampton Bike Breakfast in downtown Northampton this morning. One little point of clarification I want to make: when he talked about the cycler track between Holyoke and Hockenham Road, he meant Holyoke Street, not the city of Holyoke. It's only like a block or two long, but part of the idea of that cycle track is for when motorists come off of I-91 and they're coming into town. It's sort of a visual, it's something that'll hopefully try and slow people down from going interstate speeds as they enter into town. So back to my live guest, Brad Little, who's here in the studio with me today. So, Brad, you got to go to the bike breakfast this morning, too. That was pretty exciting for me. We went together. How has your experience of biking been in Northampton so far?
Well, using a word that is rather familiar, awesome. I thought I might have to walk down 2 miles to the festival down there. And instead, Ruthie put me in a trailer behind her bicycle and took me down herself and in regal comfort, a great comfort. It was a first-time experience. And then I got to the gathering there on the lawn and talked with people, and saw what they were trying to do, heard about this bike trail controversy and development, and it all was very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah, that was the update from Craig Della Penna giving, talking about the conversion of many railroad beds into rail trails and private property disputes that come about from that sometimes. Let's see. So, Brad, you told me, you called me like a few weeks ago, I can't remember when it was, back in April maybe, and said, you said, hey, Ruthie, I'm thinking about doing a trip to the East Coast or to Massachusetts in particular to visit colleges and universities to try and get my book in the hands of people who will read it. And then I said, great, sure, stay with me for a few days. And then I heard your trip, you emailed me and said, oh, I'm a little bit delayed. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then at Monday night potluck, 6 o'clock, all the potluck guests are arriving, and here comes Brad, just in time for potluck.
Right. Just in time, exactly so.
Sheer coincidence, I guess. But anyway, I'm so glad that you made it. Do you want to say something about your book that's motivated your trip out here?
Well, the title of this book is The Flaw in Deterrence, and it's a mathematical probability analysis of the failure of nuclear deterrence, which is the foundation of American foreign policy and the policies of all the other nuclear powers. The book is based upon a paper which I wrote in 1982 to gain entrance to the political science PhD program of the University of Chicago. And I'm getting it out now in book form because I think the problem still exists and is getting worse. That is, I think that these antagonistic nuclear arsenals, thermonuclear arsenals that the United States, Russia, and other powers have created constitute an imminent threat to the existence of the human species. They can wipe out the human species in just a few minutes. And the government and other entities that people think are responsible, most political scientists and philosophers, whatever, constantly telling the public that this is a stable system, that it can stay there forever and there will be no problems. All we have to do is keep our weapons more powerful and more numerous than those of our potential enemies and we'll be safe forever. And I think that scientifically this is an absolute misunderstanding of the situation. What do you put in these systems? You create the virtual certainty that they will be used. That is because they're governed by certain probability principles. The systems were created on the basis of what is called game theory. The idea of people are, if you can convince your so-called enemy that your ability to retaliate will always be there, you could wipe out him or her facilities at any time, that you'll never be attacked. This is a static concept. It doesn't take into consideration a fundamental physical principle, and that is that probability is a function of time. That is, over a period of time, the probability of an event happening approaches certainty. That is, it doesn't increase at any given instant, but it's over the period that it increases. And this principle is totally neglected by the people who have created these nuclear deterrent systems. Now, to give you an example, practically what it means, if you put in a nuclear missile, thermonuclear missile, in a submarine or a land-based missile base or put it on an airplane, you create an instantaneous possibility, we'll say the possibility today, that it will be fired. That's always greater than zero. That is an obvious fact. It doesn't have to be scientifically demonstrated. You have intentional launchings of this missile. You have accidents, all kinds of things. It's greater than zero. Now, when you look into the future for 10 days, 15 days, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, that probability increases. Not that it increases from day to day, but over the period it increases. And it increases according to an equation. And that equation is an exponential equation in which the exponent is the number of days you're considering. And that equation produces a curve which approaches certainty. Now, this is high school mathematics. The equation is what is called a stochastic equation, and it shows proves that probability is related to time and how it is related to time. And this equation means, very simply, that we are going to have catastrophic accidents with these weapons and eventually thermonuclear war. This is a scientific reality that is kept from the American public and the public of the world by the governmental leaders who want to have these weapon systems. And the book explains this principle and shows, gives an example of it, and it gives examples of how all of the deterrence strategists who have justified nuclear deterrence have failed to recognize the simple principle that probability is a function of time.
Yes. You were saying when we were talking earlier that that my brain is sort of rumbling to trying to digest that. But okay, so you were saying when we were talking the other day about how you feel like a lot of people try to make the moral argument against nuclear weapons, but you're just trying to make a simple, like a mathematical argument and forget about the moral argument in some level?
No, I don't want to forget about the moral argument. I'm basically a religious pacifist and believer in nonviolence by Gandhi, but the argument put forth by political scientists in all the universities and colleges of the world is that moral considerations are irrelevant to international affairs and just unrealistic and sentimental concepts. What they're interested in, they say they're interested in, is concrete scientific reality and predicting what is going to happen. And they predict that if you don't have these arsenals, we will be attacked, etc. But their argument is not scientific, basically. It's based upon game theory, and that is not a scientific approach to probability. The equation, which I mentioned, is a scientific approach, and it is the best approach that you can get scientifically, because it is exactly the approach that engineers, for instance, would take to the probability of automobile accidents or insurance companies. They use this concept all the time. If you repeatedly risk something, eventually it's going to happen. And so I want to incorporate a completely scientific, hard scientific, irrefutable concept into this refutation of nuclear deterrence and showing that nuclear weapons are a complete mistake if you want to create lasting peace and ensure the existence of the human species. Mm-hmm. Because make no mistake, if these weapon systems are used, we risk the entire wiping out of the human species.
All right. great. I mean, terrible. I wanted to also ask you, Brad. So you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and my guest today is Bradford Little of Chicago. So, Brad, one of the many, many things you've done in your life. Oh, you also have an autobiography entitled, what's it entitled?
Peace Activist.
Peace Activist, yes. So in 1964, you coordinated a walk from Quebec, the Quebec-Washington Guantanamo Peace Walk.
Right. Well, that was a rather unrealistic project in terms of human capacity. It was several thousand miles, and it started out in Quebec, Canada. And we walked south, and eventually we arrived up, not in Guantanamo, but Key West. Eventually, when we tried to go to Cuba with a little motorboat, we were stopped in Miami, and our boat was confiscated, and we were temporarily put in prison. So it really ended up being, say, but we did get down to Key West with our project. So you could say the Quebec-Washington-Key West walk for peace.
When you were at Monday Night Potluck, you started telling a story about, okay, so someone else at Potluck was from Georgia. Albany, Georgia was mentioned, and you talked about your experience with the walk in Albany. Can you tell some of that story?
Well, that was, to me, an unforgettable experience in my life. This project was racially integrated with young men and men and women, and between 20 and 40 people all the time. Our major themes were disarmament, abandonment of military forces as a means of protecting the country, nuclear disarmament. Oh, that was one theme. Another one was the end to all racial discrimination, segregation, And the final one was we wanted a lifting of the embargo against Cuba. And incidentally, we have finally, 50 years later, lifted that embargo. Almost, not entirely, but we're moving in that direction. Now, we were walking south, and as you can imagine, a racially integrated walk at that time with these themes was going to run into difficulty in deeply segregated parts of the South where racial prejudice was still very intense. And we managed to survive through very interesting because we arrived in Washington at the time of the great march to end segregation, the Washington March, and we were at the reflecting pool when Dr. King delivered his famous speech, and that was one of the great moments of the project. Mm-hmm. But then we started south of Washington, and we increasingly encountered opposition and resistance from segregationists. People began to give us death threats, but we kept going, and we arrived, we went through South Carolina. I remember, I think it might have been in Spartanburg. We went in to talk with the police chief, I think it was, about our project, because we wanted to tell these people that we weren't intending any harm to anyone and we weren't violent, and we thought that might reduce the likelihood of our being killed. Well, we talked to this police chief, and he was a Southern gentleman. He listened to what we had to say, and then I came out, and I was outside, and there was a newspaper reporter of the local newspaper waiting for us. And he said, "Well, Mr. Little, what did the police chief tell you?" And I said, "Well, I said that we had a constitutional right to carry our signs and distribute our leaflets and talk with people in this country. And what did the police chief tell you?" And he said, "Well, he didn't say much." And then the reporter said to me, "Well, Mr. Little, you're not in constitutional country now." And that was a pretty sobering and realistic statement, I think, because south of there, then we went to, we got to Atlanta, where we were, it was a rather liberal city at that time, and we stayed there for a few days to rest up, and then we dropped down further south, and we ran into a small city called Griffin. And there we ran into big trouble. We were escorted by a governmental group called the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And some of the women in our project went off into a black community to try to distribute leaflets, and they were immediately attacked and arrested by these Georgia Bureau of people. They were clubbed, they were cattle prodded with these electric cattle prods. Our people non-cooperated, they sat down, and then they were dragged along the ground and whacked with police sticks, and then we were all thrown into paddy wagons and taken to the local police station and dragged up the stairs and bumped up the stairs and cattle prodded some more and whacked some more and put in jail cells. And we didn't know what was going to happen to us. We might just be killed in that situation. But immediately there's some publicity of this, and apparently the city authorities got worried and they let us out. And we were battered by then physically and somewhat emotionally, and we returned to Atlanta, where we rested up a bit. Then we continued down. We didn't try to go through Griffin again, but we went down towards Macon. And we got to Macon, and there the police chief was waiting for us with a Stetson hat. And he looked at us, and he said, "You know, the people up north, they haven't had the guts to arrest you and put you in prison, but I do." So as soon as we stepped across the Macon boundary, we were arrested, all of us, and put into this filthy jail. The men in our project refused to work on the garbage trucks of Macon, which is, of course, a form of slave labor. And all of us were immediately put into what could only be described as a torture cell. It was a concrete cubicle with one small window at top, the barred window, a little hole through which 90-degree air was being pumped, a hole in the floor for sanitation, and that was all. And there were so many of us put in this cell that we couldn't sit down. We had to stand, or most of us sit, stand all the time. Well, it reminded of me something of the stay cells that the Nazis used in Dachau to punish prisoners, to torture them. They would put the Nazis in, Nazis would put prisoners in these little boxes where they couldn't sit, and then leave them there indefinitely. And eventually many died in that situation. And I could have seen us happening, that happening to us there in Macon. But we were there about 18 hours, I think more than 18 hours, almost a day. And then suddenly John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Well, this threw the whole political situation in the country in turmoil, and the people who governed Macon were afraid there'd be riots in their city, so they let us out. All let us out, and we all returned to Albany again. Well, then we had to wait a bit to see what was going to happen. After a few days, 10 days I think it was, we wanted to resume our walk south. But by then, the police didn't want us to walk through the cities. They said they would arrest us in Atlanta if we tried to do that. Well, one of our members was A.J. Musty, a dean of the pacifist movement. He was an elderly Presbyterian minister and a very, very astute and person, fine person. And he thought about the situation and he said, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King is going to be giving a sermon this coming Sunday at this church here in Atlanta. And I know Dr. King. And why don't we all go to that church and attend that service? And I will ask Dr. King if he and his parishioners will walk with us out of the city, see if we can do it, make it. So we went down there and we attended the service and we all met Dr. King, and Dr. King agreed to walk down with us. And he and several of his members of his church walked out of that door, and here are about, I would say, 15 or 16 police cars waiting for us and some vans to put us in, paddy wagons, and they were all ready to arrest us, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. And we walked through them completely unmolested and untouched with Dr. King, which is another unforgettable experience I had. Mm-hmm. Well, then we didn't try Macon again. We went further, and our next major obstacle or problem was Albany, Georgia. And Albany, Georgia was one tough city. It had been a slave trading center. And they had a terrible history of lynchings in Albany. And a few years before, Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had brought their people to Albany to try to break down or change or whatever the segregation system in Albany. And they met Chief Laurie Pritchett, who is a well-educated police chief, originally from the North. And Pritchett had a different strategy towards the civil rights demonstrators. He didn't beat them up or hose them or anything like that. He just put them all in prison. And the extra few hundred, he farmed out to county prisons around, and he kept them there. And the only way they could get out was by paying a fine. And he kept them there until they paid the fine. Well, then they all left. And we went down and we negotiated with Pritchett about walking through his city. And he said, well, we're not going to let you walk through our city. We're not going to let your integrated peace walk through it. And furthermore, we'll arrest you. And we beat Dr. Martin Luther King and his movement, and we'll beat you. You'll be in our jails. Well, here or there are 20 or 30 of us, and we were in a very posing physical force, and we thought about it and talked about it, had a council of nonviolence, if we call it, and we decided on a strategy that we would fast. If we were arrested, we would non-cooperate. Most of us would refuse to cooperate with the arrest, and if we were put in prison, we would not eat. Well, we did that. We were arrested immediately, and we were put in prison, rather dirty cells, and kept there. They brought in food that was we didn't eat. None of us ate. We drank water, but we refused to eat. And this went on for a couple of weeks, and then Pritchett called me out. I was the coordinator of the project and said, Little, are you folks willing to die in prison, fast to death in prison? And I said, well, Chief Pritchett, there's a lot of us think that are so opposed to racial discrimination and racial prejudice that I think some of us certainly would do that. And I believe that. I think they would. And we left him thinking about that, and we were put back in prison. Well, it kept on. The court situation was appalling. We would go to court to have a hearing. The policy in Albany was to have you serve your sentence first and then have your trial. We would go to trial. We were represented by a very, very competent African-American attorney named C.B. King, who lived there in Albany. And he would argue for our release, and the judge wouldn't listen to him, wouldn't deny all of his motions. The city attorney who was prosecuting us just turned his back on C.B. King. C.B. King was talking and put his feet up on the windowsill. C.B. King was treated a total disrespect, and of course we never won any of our arguments and were put back in jail. Well, this went on for about 2 months, and then finally...
2 months. You're still fasting. It's been two months.
Yeah, fasting. People were getting skeletal. The women were developing scurvy and bleeding at the gums, things like that. I mean, it was a savage struggle, a very, very severe struggle with this city, the discrimination laws in the city. Finally, through negotiations with the local white ministers, the city council decided that they would let a small group of five of us, an integrated peace walk, through the business section of their city with our leaflets and signs, in which we won a victory of principle. They let us out, we did that, and we got out of Albany. And then we went down to a center called, in Americus, Georgia, called Koinonia.
Okay, wait, can we back up a minute?
Are we running out of time here, Ruthie?
Well, I should say that you're listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP, 103.3 FM in Northampton. This is Out There. I'm Ruthie Woodring, and you've been listening to Brad Little, who's visiting from Chicago. Brad is an old Catholic worker friend of mine and director of the Hyde Park Nonviolent Resistance Pacifist Center in Chicago. He's been talking about a walk that he coordinated in 1963-64, the Quebec-Washington-Guantanamo peace walk. So, Brad, you fasted, and time goes on in this jail, and what was that like, having no idea if there was any end in sight or you might just die there?
Well, you make a moral decision. All of the people on the project were absolutely opposed to racial discrimination and prejudice, and they're black people on the project, and we developed these close friendships, and we were down there for a very serious purpose, and we were put in jail, and they kept us there, and we persisted in our resistance. The final part of this story comes out, of course, we continued the walk down. We got through Valdosta. We got into northern Florida. We had experiences of segregation and prejudice there. And eventually we tried to go to Cuba and were stopped by the United States government. We used a motorboat called the Spirit of Freedom, named the Spirit of Freedom. And the Spirit of Freedom was stopped. And we were arrested again. But about 5 or 6 years ago, a friend of mine who was on that project and was in prison in Albany with us, Marv Davidoff, he came to me and he said, "Brad, do you know what they're doing down in Albany?" And I said, "No." And he said, "This burn really makes me cry. It's almost unbelievable." He said, "They're dedicating the new federal courthouse." And I said, "Okay, so?" He said, "You know who they named it after?" "No, C.B. King." C.B. King, I couldn't believe it. There wasn't anybody. I would have thought the city of Albany would less name a person than C.B. King, but they had chosen to name their federal courthouse after their black attorney who had defended us, which showed to me just an enormous change of heart in the power structure of Albany, Georgia. And it is that experience, probably more than any other in my life of trying to work with nonviolence, which shows the power of nonviolence. We had touched somebody in Albany, so that from that time on, the city did not want to be known for a center of racial discrimination or prejudice. And I think that's, it's probably the most moving experience I've ever had with nonviolence. It shows that it works, but boy, you may have to make a tremendous commitment to make it work.
Yeah, it's amazing commitment and sacrifice, and it seems like it's a testament to the strength of the relationships that you had on that walk, that everyone together would give their lives for it in a slowly deteriorating kind of way. So when you did get out, just like a logistical question. When you did get out, like if you hadn't eaten for 2 months, how did you like walk and carry the signs and stuff? How did you get your bodies strong again to continue this walk?
Well, it's tough. I mean, we were down at this Koinonia, this farm, recuperated down there for a couple of weeks. I remember a few days after we arrived, I had some leaflets in my arms and was walking across the yard, and the wind began to blow, and the leaflets began to blow away, so I began to run after them, and I just fell down. I mean, my legs just completely gave out. I didn't feel any particular pain. I just collapsed. And I was just very thin and weak. Some of the girls, I said, they had scurvy. We all were much thinner. We looked emaciated. If you go on a long fast, what happens is that the body begins to metabolize your body tissues according to the importance to the body. It starts out with the superfluous flat fat that most people don't want anyway. When it gets through with that, it begins to work on the muscles, the less important muscles like the leg muscles and the arm muscles. When it gets into those bit, then it begins to work on other parts of the body, or liver, what have you. The last thing it begins to metabolize is the brain, because the brain's the most important thing. So throughout a fast, you're usually very clear-headed, and you can think clearly. But you become weaker and weaker and weaker, and then when you try to resume eating, you can develop enormous problems because your digestive system won't work. You eat ordinary food and you immediately vomit, and you can't keep anything down for a while. And this can easily be the most dangerous time because you can die from eating the wrong things right after a long fast. And I had that experience. I tried to eat too much and I vomited and had very severe intestinal problems and what have you. But we had a fellow, Ralph DeGia, with us from New York City, an Italian background, and he immediately ate a large plate of some pasta dish which was highly spiced. Didn't affect him at all. Wow. I was amazed.
Well, you seem like you've recovered very well, so that you have the energy to bike around town, or be in the back of the trailer while I'm biking around town on a hot day like today, and you drove yourself. How old are you?
Well, I'm going on 90.
You drove yourself here from Chicago. That's reminding me when we were biking around town today on the uphill parts. So Brad was in the back of the trailer and I was pedaling. We went down to bike breakfast and back. Oh, we visited Frances Crowe and hung out with her for a while. But coming back on the bike trailer, Brad's like, "Oh, I feel guilty. You're hauling me up these hills." and what my philosophy is that, I am hauling you. I'm one person working away to haul you on this bike trailer. One person you can see working and see working hard when you're going uphill. But with so much of the transportation system, there's lots of people slaving away to make it work. They're just invisible and behind the scenes, and entire countries bombed and occupied, etc. But it was just me. It was just us.
Yeah,
it was great.
Well, Ruthie's an incredibly good bicyclist and intelligent. She knows the route perfectly, and I was more and more impressed as it proceeded. I remember when we were going up, she bicycles uphill, pulling people. Very difficult. But then when we started going downhill, I immediately had a change. I said, Ruthie, now I'm pushing you.
That's
and,
right.
My conscience about this is dissipating.
That's right. This just reminds me of a joke that I heard over the weekend from my friend Rod Snelling. So this guy's traveling to another country. I don't know where. So he's traveling to another country and he's going through customs. And in customs, the customs person from the other country is checking out his passport or his visa application or whatever. And the customs person says, citizenship. And the guy says, American. And the customs person says, occupation. And the guy says, no, I'm just passing through. All right, so you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. We're going to take a little break, and I'm Ruthie Woodring, and Brad Little is here in the studio with me. I'm going to play a little bit of music from... These are Los Gigantes de la Plena, I believe. It was a band that was playing in Holyoke last Sunday, a week and a half ago. A week and a half ago, they closed the 116 bridge between Holyoke and South Hadley, the first ever street party, and the bridge was filled with people and musical groups and kids and all kinds of activities and things. Anyway, it's just like a minute of some of this band that was playing.
Dice, Aure, Aure, ¿cómo está tu mamá?
I think that was Los Gigantes de la Plena. And now I have another half interrupted clip from Spirit of the Hills Chorus, a local chorus that performed their spring concert last weekend, too. Spirit of the Hills Chorus, directed by Penny Schwartz. That was from their spring concert at the Northampton Senior Center last weekend.
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones como arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue.
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta. Ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá para acá.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Louisville, the home of the Kentucky Derby, is warming faster than other similar cities. The rapid warming is partly caused by a lack of shade trees. Mature trees help keep cities cool, so a group called Love Louisville Trees is planting maple, redbuds, ginkgo, and other species recommended for residential neighborhoods throughout the city. Volunteers like Liz Vasquez are taught how to plant a tree, supervise other volunteers, and spread the word to Louisville residents.
We canvass the neighborhoods just as one would think, going with clipboards door to door, explaining what we are doing. We call the people who receive the trees tree recipients, and they are given literature about the type of tree they have, how to properly care for that tree.
Vasquez says the tree recipients are thrilled about the beauty and environmental benefits trees provide.
Some of the areas that we've been in don't have any trees, and the people are so excited to get trees in their yard.
So far, volunteers have planted more than 1,500 trees that will shade the streets of Louisville, providing cool relief for years to come. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And that reminds me of Northampton's similar program, Tree Northampton. They have a website, treenorthampton.org, and lots of volunteers are planting trees. Actually, Dwayne and Paige and I and others are going out on Saturday to join a tree planting crew, but they've been planting around town. Paige has been very active. Paige, you heard her voice on the Bike Lab ad. But the city has a program. If you want a tree planted in your yard near the street, a shade tree, you can fill out a request form, and the city will come by. Someone will come by and evaluate it and see if they can make a good match of a tree for your yard and then come out and plant it. So I'd go to treenorthampton.org. I was thinking about trees a lot today, Brad, when we were biking, because it was really hot. And there was like this combination of trees cut down, pavement laid, soaking up the sun, and little greenhouses with internal combustion engines going by make for a hot little environment when the hot days come. How are you doing with the heat?
The heat?
Yeah.
Well, I started off in Chicago. It was very chilly, and I should have brought a pair of shorts and a short-sleeve shirt. But I'm holding up pretty well so far. I walked around a number of college and university campuses yesterday promoting this book in the hot sun, and I didn't know if I was going to make it. But today, Ruthie, thanks to your wonderful transportation, sitting in that little cart you have, it hasn't been so tough.
Good. So the book that you just mentioned, the Flaw in Deterrence, if anyone's interested in that book or how they can access that book, where have you distributed it so far since you've been here?
Well, I went to Smith, and I went to UMass, and I went to Amherst, and I went to, Hampshire College. I got to four of them yesterday, so I made it that far.
Mount Holyoke is still on your list?
Well, I got there, but I got there too late after 5 o'clock and the library was closed. Mm-hmm. But I was happy that I was able to do what I did.
Mm-hmm. Another little story that you were telling, Brad, that I found curious. So where you live in Hyde Park, you say there's a lot of other people who live there who throw away some pretty fancy things. Can you tell me about the wagon that you found in the trash?
Yeah. Well, I have sympathy with the Catholic worker approach towards scavenging. I try to use things efficiently, and I was passing a neighbor's trash can one day, and there was a good-sized cart, four-wheeled cart in it, and it seemed to be homemade. It wasn't the thin sheet metal type that you buy for kids or anything, and it lacked a wheel. So I took it out and took it home and bought a wheel for it and put it on it, and began to use it to carry refrigerators and other things around. It was very sturdy. And well, I had a number of friends in the area. One was a physicist named Leo Serin, and he'd worked at the University of Chicago, and he'd been a member of the team under the leadership of Enrico Fermi, who operated the first atomic pile on December 2nd, 1942, under the west football stands of Stagg Field. This is a very, very important event historically. These people were trying to see if they could get a self-sustained nuclear reaction, because if they could, they knew that they could make plutonium, a new 235, and then they could make a nuclear weapon. And these scientists were gathered there, and the pile was, the control rod was pulled out of the pile, and then Fermi was looking at his slide rule and the gauges, and he suddenly said the reaction was self-sustained, at which point they knew they could build the bomb. Well, I go out and demonstrate it. The monument that is on the spot where the pile was, this monument was designed by Henry Moore, a famous English sculptor. I think it's the most important historical place in Chicago. I demonstrate there every Hiroshima Day. And one day, Leo Sarin, who'd been part of that team of physicists, was in my house. We went in the backyard, and he saw this cart. And he said, you know what that is? And I said, no, well, it's a cart. It's handmade. And he said, that is the cart that was made by the physicists and engineers of the Manhattan Project to carry the carbon blocks that went into making the atomic pile. I was just amazed. Here I possessed an artifact of the dawn of the atomic age. So I've used it ever since to carry around refrigerators and have told people about it. And I put a new top on it. As people, once people learn what it may have been, they keep shy of it. They're afraid that it's radioactive. But I assure them that it's not.
You said you bring it with you to demonstrations sometimes, too?
I did once. But when I saw how leery people were, I stopped doing that. But I still show it to folks who come over to my house. You see, I think that experiment... The whole development of nuclear energy, I think, first for the purpose of making the bomb and then to develop electricity, was a mistake because you can't control it for several reasons. First of all, for making the nuclear weapons, I think they're going to destroy the human species unless they're deactivated. That's the way the situation is going, and that's the way it is. In terms of atomic power, nuclear power, it has two basic problems. One is that the byproducts of it, these fission products, are radioactive. Radioactivity can last as long as several billion years, and it can't be effectively stored anywhere. It just continues to contaminate the environment. That's a major problem. The second problem is that whenever you operate these piles, you're producing plutonium and U-235, the material for weapons. And for both reasons, I think it is a mistake to continue with atomic energy as part of our civilization. We should go with solar power, water power, all of these kinds of energies that are not contaminating to the environment.
I think we should go with using less energy. You know, I've seen the solar farm on Route 5, like when you go from between Holyoke and Northampton, there's a new solar farm because there's nothing. When I think of farm, I think of at least things that are green, even if it is monoculture. But there's nothing farm about it in my mind. It's just like this dead space, you know, the cut down trees and put this, I don't know, I don't even know what solar panels are made out of, plastic, polycarbonate, metal, whatever they're made out of. But like electricity is not something we can eat or drink or whatever. So that's my little two cents about that. I think that there should be trees instead, and we should live in the trees and eat apples and leaves and bark.
Okay.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm Ruthie Woodring. Brad Little has been my guest in the studio today. Democracy Now! Will be coming up in about 5 minutes at 5 o'clock. And Brad, do you have any, before the hour runs out, do you have any words of wisdom for the younger generation?
Well, I don't know that I have any particular wisdom. First of all, I've enjoyed very much being in this area and being with Ruthie and the Pedal people, which I think is a great enterprise, distributing this document, The Flaw in Deterrence, at these colleges and the university. I think that's been very rewarding to me. I hope that young people will realize the seriousness of our situation. When you create thousands and thousands of thermonuclear bombs and aim them at the cities and military bases around the world of different countries, your civilization is in a terminal situation because these weapon systems will be used. That is a scientific fact. And when they're used, there is nothing left of human civilization. And we need to get rid of them. And I think we should get rid of them by nations simply deactivating them immediately without waiting for treaties or anything else. There is much less chance of our country being destroyed by an attack on us by somebody if we didn't have weapons than by keeping the weapons and keeping these arsenals in place. Science simply tells you irrevocably that if you keep them in place, they're going to be used. And they can be used at any time. Any time I wake up in the morning alive in this situation, I think I'm just lucky, and that goes for the whole human species. Mm-hmm. So get out there and protest and demonstrate and demand the truth about this situation.
Well, thank you so much, Brad, for your passion and commitment to making a better world throughout your life and your continuing energy. It's an honor to have you visit and come to the studio. Thanks.
And thank you, Ruthie.
That's it for Out There today.